The world is not yet on track to avoid dangerous, irreversible climate change. But while the gravity of the task may appear daunting, there are plenty of positive signs that we can accelerate action to create thriving, sustainable societies. The interest is obvious. The ideas abound. The innovations exist or are currently being developed. And investments are increasing. So how do we harness this at scale in order to drive climate action? How can we expedite our path towards positive tipping points across key sectors of the economy? Welcome to Ahead of the Curve. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a diverse community of people passionate about creating positive impact. Throughout this series, produced in collaboration between The Conduit and Systemic, we'll bring to your attention some of the people, policies, organizations, and innovations that are creating positive tipping points we need for a net zero society. Our conversations with leading experts will reveal how climate action is already transforming economies, and they'll offer actionable insights into how we can move further faster to meet the objectives of the Paris Agreement. This episode is recorded at the Conduit Studio at COP26, and this series is produced in collaboration with Systemic, a B Corp dedicated to making economic systems regenerative and sustainable. Global transformation of food and land use systems is needed now more than ever to improve food security, ensure healthier diets, and safeguard biodiversity. Central to achieving this and unlocking trillions in social returns each year is protecting nature and addressing food and land use systems' contribution to the climate crisis. Jeremy Leggett is joined by Talia Smith discussing how food and land use systems can accelerate towards positive tipping points. Jeremy is a social entrepreneur, writer, and climate campaigner. He founded Solar Century, one of the world's most respected solar energy companies, and he also founded SolarAid. After taking a DPhil in Earth Science at the University of Oxford, he taught at Imperial College of Science and Technology. He was a scientific director of the climate campaign at Greenpeace and has written four books about the climate crisis. He embarked on the Bunloit project in March 2020, which hopes to rewild and repeople the highlands through optimally sequestering carbon, growing biodiversity, creating green jobs, and generating sustainable profit for purpose. Joining Jeremy is Talia Smith, who is co-director of knowledge generation at the Food and Land Use Coalition Secretariat, housed at Systemic, where a passion is helping to deliver solutions to transform global food and land use systems to work better for people, nature, and the climate. Prior to joining Systemic, Talia was an international development consultant, designing infrastructure, land use, and natural resource management programs in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. So thank you both for joining us. Jeremy, I want to start with you, and I want to you to give us why, in the context of COP and in the quest for net zero, tipping towards nature-based solutions is so vital in the overall architecture of what we're trying to achieve here this week.
It's vital because no matter how well we do with all the other hardware of cutting greenhouse gas emissions, solar, wind power, batteries, everything else, we know we're still going to have to take a lot of carbon down out of the atmosphere. And for someone like me who's lived through the solar revolution and actually had the privilege of riding the wave, the exponential growth wave, of the emergence of this amazing industry, the least expensive energy ever invented, according to the IEA, and that's come from nowhere, from probably the most expensive energy when it started. And having lived through that, founded a company, and survived on the surf, as it were, I'm filled with cautious optimism because I know what it looks like and feels like to get exponential growth. And we've done that in 20 years. We could have done it quicker. if we'd had more belief from policymakers earlier on, and frankly, less enemy action from the fossil fuel lobbyists and the industry there. But we did it in 20 years, and it is what it is. And I think that can be done again with nature-based solutions, and our Bunloit project aims to help make that come about. And the key thing that helped solar take off was believability and proof of concept, if you like, verification that this strange technology just sits there with no moving parts can actually deliver all this amazing electricity. And we helped do that in Solar Century, the company I founded. And at Bunloit, in the Bunloit Rewilding Project, we're going to try and speed up the investability of nature-based solutions by providing the kind of proof and quantification power that investors are going to need and policymakers are going to need in order to kickstart this second exponential growth story.
So we're going to dig into the details on that in a moment. But I just wanted to ask you, Talia, what are the kind of more systemic changes we have to make in food systems and in land use in order to move us towards positive tipping points in this space?
Great question. I mean, Jeremy's talked a lot right now about sort of why nature is so important, and nature has to also sit within a context of the wider food and land use system. The reason why we're destroying nature today is because it's more valuable. Trees are more valuable cut down than they are left standing. And that's often because of our agricultural production systems and the commodities that we produce to feed the world. Now, of course, feeding the world is a very good thing, but we can feed the world whilst also protecting and restoring nature. Some work we've done at the Food and Land Use Coalition has modeled different approaches to how we can shift our agricultural practices and protect and restore nature. We can do that while freeing up 1.2 billion hectares of land that we could restore back to nature. And we can also do that while putting foods on people's plates and also sequestering carbon, reducing carbon, both through our mitigation measures, but also by enhancing the ability of carbon sinks. So overall, you know, nature sits at the heart of a transformation that has to touch on all of our food systems, from what we consume through to how food is transported and distributed along supply chains, and ultimately how it ends up, how it circles back into our natural resources.
So you you've just given us a tiny précis of all the work that you've done as a kind of pioneer in the solar space, and there must be parallels between what you experienced there and what you're trying to put into action now. And I'd love you to sort of tell us what you've learned from those, where are the applicable lessons and where are there, you know, disjunctures between that and the present?
Yeah, I mean, the similarities are in the patterns of investment. And when solar started, it was the domain of the pioneer investors, family offices, high net worth individuals, you know, a few adventurous venture capitalists, but, you know, people who could see the future and willing to and able to take a punt on it. The financial institutions didn't come to the party until the writing was really pretty clear on the wall. And that's disappointing. And we all know why when we look at the dynamics of banks and insurance companies, and that's why the likes of Mark Carney are trying to wrestle with their general uselessness, if I may be frank, in these matters. And it's the same again with nature-based solutions, where the early investors are not the financial institutions. For all their heady talk now about existential threats to markets and therefore their companies, their institutions, you know, they're just not there yet. So that's frustrating, but we know from the solar revolution how to do it. We just got to show them that this can work, it can be quantified, it can be great, and then they'll come piling in. I wish that, frankly, that politicians would just tell them where to invest up to a percentage of their capital. But that's one similarity between the two revolutions. The big difference and the reason for hope is that last time in solar, you know, people like me were accused of being rootless dreamers, and I use those words advisedly. I mean, I was accused of that by a government minister, and it's burned on my memory from those days. And, you know, it was tough because people didn't have belief. Now, it's a very different kettle of fish. You talk to multiple stakeholders. They all assume this is going to happen. And that includes, for heaven's sakes, the estate agents in Scotland who are selling all the land. You know, they no longer, a few years ago, they were selling it based on how many tons of grouse you could blast out of the sky. Now they're selling it on natural capital and you know, talking the talk. And right across the political spectrum, you know, whatever party you're in, people say this is going to have to happen. We're going to have to change the land management economic reward paradigm in order to speed it up. So, yeah, reasons for hope.
So now let's get into specifics. Tell us exactly what you're intending to do at Bandoit and how you're intending to do it and what the outcomes will be if you are succeed beyond your wildest dreams or just based on the business plan.
Well, we've been going for 18 months and so we're right on the front line and we're basically measuring and quantifying everything that moves. We're going to try and get as granular as we can with carbon, both, you know, in the peatlands, in the woodlands, in the grassland, put it all together, come up with a baseline, show how we've done it, show how relatively easy it is and how people can sort of defensively cut corners by measuring stuff on the ground and then cross-correlating with satellite measurements so you can do it at scale over bigger areas. Biodiversity, we're counting all the species and we're lucky enough to be a pretty biodiverse place. But of course, you know, everywhere you can make improvements. And so once you've got a baseline, then you measure again and you keep going and you demonstrate a trend. And it's making those trends monetizable, to use the business word, that is really going to make this take off. Because at that point, you get landowners who aren't perhaps motivated the way someone like me is and my compadres. You get those landowners to look at what's happening and say, well, you know what, that is that's a better way to do it. And we'll go that route now, even if we aren't necessarily climate campaigners.
So let's fast forward and say you measure everything now, you establish all of your baselines, you take all the different metrics that you're going to look for significant areas of improvement on, all of your hopes and projections, come to fruition, you're able to start monetizing it. Give us a thought of what happens when that then takes off, if that then becomes something that rolls out in multiple jurisdictions. What are the returns start looking like? How do land use patterns start changing? How do investments in rural land start changing? I mean, paint the kind of from the early days of Solar Century to what it became. You know, show us that image.
Well, once you cross the divide, once you get to the tipping point, you will be posed. We will be posed with a whole range of what I would think of as quality problems. But we've got to get to that point first. And right now we're talking to senior officials in the Scottish Government, for example, who are saying, we have no idea how we're going to do this. And by the way, we're open to your advice and the advice of people like you. So we've got to get beyond that. And there's a wonderful sort of thought process collective thought process that could go into fashioning the most sustainable regulatory framework and reward system for this sort of thing. I mean, the basics are obvious. They're going to have to say to the hill farmers, sorry, you're not going to get subsidies for putting sheep and cattle up on the hills any longer. We know that's just wrecking the environment. And you will instead get subsidies and support for whatever, the new regime. Storing carbon, growing biodiversity. So then your question becomes, what does the landscape look like? Naturally, it's going to recover. It's a process of nature recovery. Some of us call it rewilding. Others don't like that word. I think it's a great word. It's going to be wilder. And there'll be great corridors of wild nature recovery land. It'd be fabulous. But there will be problems. And one of them will be, you know, to what extent is it going to be corporatized? Are we going to have giant corporations buying up vast tracts of places like Scotland in order to sequester carbon, grow biodiversity, and then offshore the profits? I don't think that's going to work. I think you have to work with local communities and get the best of both worlds. So one of the things we're going to do in the Bunloit Rewilding Project is really try and pioneer that frontier where we can bring in local community organizations, companies, everything else, alongside external capital and outside interests who, you know, want to and need to benefit from these nature-based solutions.
So you've, Talia, spent a lot of time thinking about what are the enabling conditions that can help put wind in Jeremy's sails on a project like this. So what do you, if you were policymaker for a day and you had your druthers and you were able to say, I will do the following A, B, C, D, E measures to make it easier for this to scale and grow and to make other people feel inclined to replicate it, what are the sorts of things you would do?
Great question. And we think about those conditions in five different ways, and maybe I can kind of go through them quickly and describe how a policymaker might use that those five conditions to think about the types of policies he or she might be making. The first is economic competitiveness. We need solutions to be price parity, and whether or not that's, for example, a business model that is just as economically viable as an alternative, that price parity or economic competitiveness needs to be there. So step number one is removing, as Jeremy said, some of the sort of current perverse subsidies that are incentivizing unsustainable production and making current practices more economically viable than projects like Bunnoit, and repurposing those and start paying for public goods, which is hopefully what the UK is going to be doing through its new environmental land management scheme. Details to be determined, but more repurposing of nature damaging subsidies to start incentivizing public goods. That's sort of step number one, economic competitiveness. The second is thinking about performance. And performance is also really linked to the question of metrics and how do we measure performance and success in our society and our economies. Right now it's often measured in GDP. If you're a product or a business, it's thinking about sort of the taste of a product or the performance of an electric vehicle, how it performs compared to a sort of a petrol or combustion engine vehicle. That performance indicator also needs to be there. So we need investment in R&D and technologies to make sure that both our metrics, but also our performance indicators are also there. The third is accessibility. So we need access to finance and also access to knowledge and tools and human capital and skills. So that's third. And markets, whether or not that's different types of products that are going on a market or whether or not that's access to financial markets. The fourth is cultural norms and social norms. We need solutions to be normalized in people's consciousness. We see a lot of backlash of policies that are introducing, for example, a meat tax or indeed a carbon tax, even though we've been talking about this for a long time. We need solutions to be normalized in public consciousness so that citizens and consumers are demanding the shift and enabling policymakers to also enact the right policies that will support projects like Bunnoit. And the fifth enabling condition is capability. And this kind of comes back to knowledge and education and investments in knowledge of how to implement a project like rewilding, how to adopt different information networks that we can use to get the metrics that we need. And that is really similar to the accessibility point. But those five conditions in tandem are what we believe is necessary to enact a system-wide tipping point. But it means that what's also crucial is that those conditions need a whole host of actions by not just policymakers, but a whole host of other actors. As Jeremy was saying, financial institutions need to be there, not at the very end when the risk-reward ratios are in their favor, but when they also can see the direction of travel. And that requires a sense of common vision setting. And I think we maybe take for granted that we have a sense of where we want to go and what our future of our landscape and our economy looks like, but we aren't quite there yet. We need a clear sense of where we are and where we need to get to in order for us to really see that writing on the wall and start working towards those enabling conditions.
So let me ask both of you this. Policymakers respond to politics. They are the servants of politics in some senses. And one of the things I've heard time and time and time again here at COP is that the climate movement and maybe even climate entrepreneurs have not always done a good job in putting into practice some of the stuff around a just transition, making sure that what we do works for ordinary people, gives them a sense that they're co-benefits, that this transition will not occur at their expense in a world of increasing inequality, that their interests are at the heart of this transition, not some nice added sort of extra thing that you put in to buy them off, right? So in this model, especially, which is in some ways about preserving vast tracts of lands in rural areas where there may or may not be people. I suspect there are people there. How do you make sure that they are also beneficiaries of this, and how do you model in participation and benefits for local communities?
I mean, step one is get them in the room, start talking about them in abstract. I know you know that, and everyone knows that, but I just, being here at COP, it is a little bit disheartening. There is very much a who's inside the room and who's outside the room. And we have to just acknowledge that first off. So talk to the communities and engage with them and talk about their vision of the future as much as our vision. It's the same, it has to be the same vision or it will not work. So that for me is sort of step number one.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I personally don't believe that we will beat climate meltdown and biodiversity collapse without the full fighting engagement of local communities wherever we are in the world. And, you know, I'm sitting on the front line in the Highlands of Scotland, where I see it very graphically. The price of land is going through the roof, and it's being driven by two main things, of course, COVID and the flight from the people's desire to get out into the rural setting. Which is no bad thing if you're in a place like Scotland, which is underpopulated and has a government that is keen on repopulation. But the other thing that's happening, of course, is that the green incentives that people can see coming are causing speculation. So that's one of the main drivers of the rising price of land. And it can't continue because it's creating fundamental social injustice. I'm employing rangers on the Bunloit estate, and some of them can't even afford to rent, let alone buy. And they're not on bad salaries. And the reason for this is the soaring price of the land. So I think we have to figure out ways of bringing in local community organizations, local community companies that we can co-venture with, and they can co-own the land with the entities that are coming in. And this will not sit well with your typical bank or insurance company who think, we'll just buy a few thousand hectares of Scotland and offset our carbon and get someone to manage it for us and that'll be fine. No, it won't. It's not going to work. And the people of the Highlands won't accept it. And ultimately, the politicians will kick back. And I think you'll set back the process of solving that. Whereas if you're all working together in some sort of collection of models where you're marrying the best of both worlds, and we hope to play a pioneering role in this, in the Bunloit Rewilding Project and the scaling mechanism we have, which we call, with breathtaking originality, Highlands Rewilding, we hope that we will be able to introduce co-ownership models that will really accelerate things, and that will include the sequestration of carbon and the growth of biodiversity, because if local communities get involved in doing that and they see their pensions linked in with it, their livelihoods, the land they own, co-own, I think that'll work better than a corporatized approach to nature-based solutions.
And a quick follow-up on that, is there a way of designing rewilding projects that are consciously, intensively job-creating in ways that are not place some of the kind of leave nature to itself at risk, and is there a tension
yes.
there?
Yes, you've got to put people, your rewilding has to have people central to the landscape as you go. And we're living this in the second estate that we're particularly, that we're operating, Beldorney, where the so-called Forest of Hope, the legacy forest for COP26 is going to be planted beginning next year and regenerated, a mixture of both. And when that was announced, that this is what we'd be doing on this 800-acre estate, three neighbouring landowners got in touch and said, well, look, wait a minute, okay, we're right next door, can't we take part in this as well? Answer, You bet. And then there was a local community charity called the Cabreg Trust, which exists to bring people back to this heavily underpopulated area and give them jobs, livelihoods, and homes. They volunteered to run with the ball of bringing all the landowners, small and large, together, all up the Deveron catchment to try and create a major corridor. So, you know, you've got two things there. You've got fundamental active involvement of a local community and leadership by a local community, and you've got the kind of scale, potentially, if we can make it all hang together, that will really begin, you know, to shift the dial on carbon and biodiversity gain.
It is those multiple and interconnected co-benefits, I think, is just what's incredibly exciting about what you're doing. So I'm going to conclude with this. We're getting to the end of COP. You have a specific project. You thought deeply about the kind of policy stuff that needs to be done to enable this. What has emerged from COP that is going to be helpful to this? And where has COP perhaps underperformed, but there are areas that can be improved on?
I guess the thing I'm most excited about at COP this year is that nature really is on the agenda. And there have been other days where there was, you know, Forest Day or there's a Nature Day here or there, but it really feels for the first time that people are recognizing that nature is central to the climate crisis. And that is a real huge progress that we should celebrate. I think food is, and the sort of wider system and the sort of sets of enabling conditions we've been talking about that needs to happen alongside that recognition is not yet fully on the agenda. So that's the sort of other area I would say needs further work, is really making sure that the whole system is both on the agenda and in the room. But I really do feel like I'm leaving Glasgow really inspired, both because I'm hearing about amazing initiatives like Bunloit, but also because it's on the agenda for really the first time in my eyes.
Jeremy.
Yes, I'd echo that, of course. But to be specific to one example, I've heard a lot about peatlands here, which is great. I have to hold my hand up and say I'm among those historically in the climate business who have really underestimated soils in general and peatlands in particular. And of course, we're all discovering now that they offer huge amounts of relatively low-cost, low-hanging fruit in carbon emissions reductions. And that's super exciting because these are easy wins, should be easy wins. And there's everything to play for.
So thank you both very much. I found that to be an incredibly interesting conversation. I am going to place up a marker down to say 18 months or 24 months, or you choose your timeline. We'll have you back and we'll take the baseline and discuss the uplift, but also the more systemic stuff that if this use case becomes what I'm sure it will be, what it can be done to scale and spread and how the enabling policy environment has either helped or hurt. So thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Ahead of the Curve, produced in partnership with Systemic, who are addressing the world's biggest challenges with new solutions for the benefit of business, society, and the planet. Find out more about Systemic at systemic.earth. You can connect with The Conduit and our community of change makers by visiting theconduit.com. This podcast series is available on The Conduit's website and on all major podcast platforms on the Conduit Conversations channel.